Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Shahid Buttar, the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defence Committee, to discuss the contents of the Defence Authorisation Bill the President had threatened to veto but now appears willing to sign into law. We will examine provisions in the bill the Pentagon and the FBI opposed, which the White House now accepts, and determine how much they pose a threat to the civil liberties of Americans exercising their constitutional rights under the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments. Then, with the announcement of a moratorium on the planned closure of more post offices and 250 mail processing plants that would eliminate 28,000 more jobs, we will discuss the real reasons the Postal Service is in financial difficulty, as opposed to the often stated misreporting by the mainstream press that the Internet is putting the Post Office out of business. The president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, Frederick Rolando, joins us to lay out the reasons why the same Congress now calling for a plan to save the Post Office is responsible for shackling it with a uniquely onerous pre-funded health and retirement fund that has billions in surplus. Then finally, we'll examine an alternative approach to the growing confrontation with Iran over its nuclear program. Mohammed Ayoub, the University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, joins us to discuss why Iran wants a nuclear weapon and how best to deal with them once they have it. Here's an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? Joining us now is Shahid Buttar, who is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution. Previously, he was Director of a national program to combat racial and religious profiling by federal authorities, an Associate Director of the American Constitution Society, and a public interest litigator in private practice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shahid Buttar.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ian.
And today, of course, is a fairly critical day in terms of the Defense Authorization Bill that the president has threatened to veto. And some of the provisions have been, at least some of the objections to the White House have been altered sufficiently, particularly over Iran. But I take it that on the central issue that has got civil libertarians alarmed, the news is not good.
That's right. Originally, the White House had promised to veto the Defense Authorization Act, particularly because it included provisions that would authorize military detention without trial of U.S. citizens. And while the White House's concerns with respect to, for instance, ensuring that the FBI has an opportunity to interrogate people suspected of terrorism, and that, you know, that concern has been addressed by Congress, but the underlying concerns about military detention for U.S. citizens have not. And it does appear that the president may be poised to sign a bill that dramatically eviscerates the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution in one fell swoop while cutting out the Article III judiciary at the end of a relatively secret process in Congress in a really profound lack of transparency and, I dare say, an abdication of the oaths of office of everyone involved.
So let's go through these objections systematically. Now, the posse comitatus objection, the idea of using the military as police in the United States that came out of the end of the Civil War, where does that stand? Has that line been crossed?
Well, the bill is ambiguous with respect to the conditions under which U.S. citizens would be detained militarily. But the fact that it allows military detention at all would frontally assault precisely that provision. The Posse Comitatus Act has stood for over 100 years. And if you think about the very definition of freedom, one of the things you might include on it is the ability of a country not to be subject to its own military. And that's precisely what this bill would erode.
And in terms of the amendments of the Constitution that it violates, that walk us through those.
Sure. So the First Amendment protects several rights, including the right to speak, which is to say the right to maintain beliefs, and also the right to assembly, which is to say the right to protest. And particularly because we have long treated First Amendment-protected activism as terror, the bill allows potentially for activists to be detained militarily. So let's unpack that first piece. There are a whole different range of ways in which speech, nonviolent speech, has been criminalized. So, for instance, a separate act of Congress that passed years ago, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, it declares as terrorism the act of picketing the home of a life sciences executive. So if you have concerns, for instance, let's say hypothetically around genetically modified foods, Or let's pick a different site. Let's take the case of testing drugs on monkeys. And let's say you go to the home of a researcher who works at a lab, and you have a picket line, and all you do is raise your voice and carry a sign. You are, in the eyes of the federal government, a terrorist. And under this bill, you would not get a right to trial unless the president certified that you were supposed to have a civilian process. And that's obviously a real, really deep problem. And much of the reason why our country has been so successful over the last 250 years is precisely because we encourage people to speak their minds. And this bill would vastly increase the potential costs of speaking your mind. Whether you care about environmental issues, whether you care about peace and justice issues, or foreign policy issues, whether you care about the right to bear arms, whether you care about reproductive rights in any particular direction. You know, we've got cases here in not far from where I live. I'm in D.C. and in Maryland. The state police were caught infiltrating groups on both sides of the reproductive choice debate. And so, you know, whatever one thinks of that issue, presumably one can be a terrorist. And it's this collapse of the distinction between dissent and terror by our nation's national security establishment that really makes this bill so scary to the First Amendment.
So let's go to the Fifth.
So the Fifth Amendment ensures due process in particular, and one of the things, it's very closely wedded to the Sixth Amendment, which ensures the right to trial and access to counsel. And the point there is that if the government is going to intrude on your life and deny you the opportunity to do anything, or in this case, something as fundamental as your own individual liberty, there has to be a process, right? You're supposed to have a chance to confront your accusers and witnesses. You're supposed to have access to a representative who can plead your case before an impartial judge. Under this bill, all of those things would be taken. You wouldn't have access to counsel necessarily. Even if you did, you wouldn't have access to evidence or to confront your accusers, and you wouldn't have an impartial judge. These are all the problems that people have noted, particularly at the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay and the combatant status review tribunals that happened there. The particular scary part about the National Defense Authorization Act is it would take Guantanamo Bay and import it into the United States, not the facility, but the principle, the idea that people can be detained indefinitely without ever having a chance to appear before a judge and have their day in court. Those are very fundamental freedoms, and the fact that that would happen at all, that's the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, let alone to activists in particular, that's the First Amendment, is much of why civil libertarians are so concerned.
So does this mean that we've already witnessed a very militarized police appearing on the streets of the United States? Largely since 9/11, they've been given a lot of military equipment. And now you're telling us to prevent these violations of some of our most basic rights, the First, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment, the only defense that activists have in the United States now against being labeled terrorists and imprisoned without trial is a waiver by the president?
Under this bill, that's one way of interpreting it. Now, there's ambiguity. Some have claimed that Senator Feinstein's proviso in the bill, which says that it won't change anything about detainee policy, will help. I don't really, quite frankly, see that, particularly because what we're talking about here is not detainee policy, but rather criminal justice. And second, you know, courts are very shallow arbiters and protections of our rights these days. I mean, the federal courts were created to check and balance executive power, but if you look at their operation over the last generation in particular, courts have become enablers of executive power to a much greater extent than they've checked or balanced it in more or less any context. You could say that across the criminal justice arena. You could say that across, I think in particular, the phenomenon of courts deferring to state secrets essentially means that were you to potentially be accused, let's say you tried to challenge a detention in court, you know, courts don't scrutinize claims of secrecy by the executive branch. It's just not what they tend to do. We live in an era where courts are very deferential rather than independent. And so there is the theoretical chance that a well-intentioned judge who cares about the Constitution somewhere in the country might intervene if you happen to be in the right court. But I think that's a pretty thin thread on which to hang the entire edifice of our liberty and freedom.
Well, I recall, though, during the Bush-Cheney revelations about torture, before they were revealed, in fact, that the Supreme Court did strike them down in terms of military tribunals, didn't they?
In the Guantanamo cases, yeah, the detainee cases are the one area under the Bush administration when the Article III judiciary did exercise a check. And we can distinguish that in the first instance from all the surveillance cases where, you know, the courts insulated, for instance, the NSA's warrantless wiretapping scheme that tracks your emails and your phone calls. That's been insulated by courts from ever even appearing before the public. No one even knows the full scope of the program because it remains secret. And in the cases that have challenged it, they've been, you know, thrown out of court, again, around this deference to state secrets. Currently, there's a case in Southern California, in fact, challenging the FBI's infiltration of a series of faith institutions. And in that case, too, the Obama Justice Department, the Holder Justice Department, I should say, under the Obama administration, has claimed that just even hearing the case would expose state secrets, and so it can't be heard. And that's the current claim before the court. In the detention cases, there were a series of court decisions that attempted to reiterate the right to trial. It's interesting to note what ultimately happened, though. In every single case, Congress overruled the court, and in the most recent round of litigation, the court, and I think it was 2008, was the Boumediene decision, which ensured, again, for essentially the third time, that detainees at Guantanamo Bay enjoy a right to habeas corpus, and then you look at the subsequent jurisprudence in the D.C. Circuit, and it's like that case never happened. And in fact, there are currently dozens of detainees at Guantanamo Bay whom the Army and the executive branch have cleared for release, but they can't be moved anywhere, A, because the D.C. Circuit stands in the way, and B, because Congress tied the president's hands with respect to detainee resettlement. So while courts do occasionally check executive abuses, and one would hope, in the context of indefinite detention without trial, as the court has defended the rights of detainees, that the court might vindicate the rights of particular U.S. citizens who would be detained. But just to be, you know, look at the facts on the ground, to get to the Supreme Court is at least a 3-year process. So unless we're comfortable with U.S. citizens, and potentially activists in particular, being locked up without any right to review for 3 years on the basis of their speech, there's still plenty of reasons to be concerned about the National Defense Authorization Act.
And Shahid Bhattar, you don't see any quick challenge then from the Supreme Court if, given the severe nature of these foundations of our liberties, First, Fifth, and Sixth, being diluted in such a way to change the very nature of our liberties?
You're right, absolutely, that the bill is poses a very fundamental change to our liberties. And there are two tracks on which court challenges happen. They can be as applied in a particular instance, and that's the scenario we just talked through in which, you know, maybe someone, let's say the bill passes and 6 months from now someone gets detained militarily, and then they file a case and it goes up on appeal and then before the Supreme Court, and that will take several years. There's an alternative track, facial challenges to bills for just being unconstitutional on their face. And it is precisely that scenario that I think the court would be very poorly poised to defend the Constitution, particularly because the last time the Supreme Court wrote a seminal opinion, you know, one that has attained controlling force over time in the arena of executive power, really dates back to the Korean War, when President Truman attempted to nationalize the steel mills. And in the Youngstown Sheet and Steel case, the concurring opinion by Justice, I believe it was Jackson, has been held essentially as the governing framework. And Justice Jackson's opinion constructs a scenario, or a framework, let's say, in which the court is to assess assertions of executive power, like, for instance, the right to detain people without trial, in the context of Congress's act. And where Congress has attempted to deny that power to the president or has merely remained silent after considering it, that's a strike against it, so to speak, and that's supposed to be a basis for the court to intervene. And that's what the court did in the Youngstown Sheet and Steel case, because the Congress had never authorized the president to nationalize the steel mills in Youngstown, Ohio. But however, here, in this case, Congress is authorizing the president to militarily detain people. And so under the Steel Caesars case and that framework, the court today wouldn't have a hook. Under that framework, this act, however unconstitutional and however offensive to fundamental liberties, the court wouldn't have a basis to rule against it. Now, having said all that, while courts are theoretically on the basis of applying neutral principles consistently over time, you know, that's what distinguishes law from politics, our contemporary Supreme Court under Chief Justice Roberts seems to be quite inclined to throw precedent to the wind in its effort to reshape society. And so it may well be the case that the court would be inclined to hear a challenge, but this is, you know, this is sort of the equivalent of jurisprudential dice rolling.
And you've just told us, Shahid Bhatta, that if a U.S. citizen, say a protester with the Occupy movement, for example, was detained by the military, that may become a test case, but it'll take a while, 2 or 3 years. Under the new rules that the president apparently agreed to, and he's apparently not going to veto this bill, there's some sort of waiver that he's been given to take the curse off it, if you will. But first of all, under military detention, I wasn't sure that the habeas corpus applies. Would you know that somebody's disappeared?
Not necessarily, right? I mean, that's just it. You don't. None of the criminal justice's systems protections apply in military detention, so you wouldn't know your rights necessarily. No one would ever tell them to you.
But your family wouldn't know, or your girlfriend wouldn't know you disappeared.
Not that this is essentially a bill that authorizes disappearances. I mean, it could well be the case that the executive branch would construct some program to notify, for instance, friends and family. But one of the key pieces about this issue that's important to note is that it's not the current president who, he will certainly have the ability to use this law too, but it's every future president too. And the nature of the military is that they can just change the process at whim, right? So, A, no one knows what the current practice would be. B, nothing would keep it from changing arbitrarily. And C, this is particularly what I'd invite your listeners to think about. Do you want a President Gingrich holding the power to detain people arbitrarily without trial? Or would you want a President Palin with that power, or, you know, pick someone on the other side of the aisle? But the point here is that executive power, again, to use the words of Justice Jackson, is like a loaded gun lying around waiting for some president to grab it. And it's what the world will look like after this bill passes is very hard to say, both because the bill is ambiguous and because, quite frankly, the military doesn't even know what to do with it. The Secretary of Defense opposed this bill throughout, and I think one of the reasons is that the military doesn't know how to detain U.S. citizens. It's not something they've ever had to, I mean, they have done it before, don't forget. It wasn't only 60 years ago, I suppose, that the Japanese internment locked up 100,000 Americans without any suspicion of wrongdoing. So we're basically stepping back into that era. It's not an ethnic roundup, but it is a roundup authority, and it's an authority that any future president could abuse. And the danger of these powers being potentially politicized is precisely why, historically, our nation has very consistently and assertively rejected these powers and kept them from emerging. And I think it's particularly galling and ridiculous, quite frankly, were it not so serious, that this is happening now in 2011. You know, Osama bin Laden was just killed earlier this year. Al-Qaeda is a shadow of its former self. It's been decimated. Why exactly are we shredding the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, along with the Posse Comitatus Act, and cutting out the Article III judiciary over a ragtag band of somewhere between 50 and 100 people in the mountains of Afghanistan, who the CIA trained 30 years ago? I mean, it's really ridiculous when you take a look at what has happened, you know, stepping back from the particular bill to think about this in the sort of context of our nation's history. Were it not so serious, it would be it would be a really funny joke.
Well, just in closing, though, Shahid, it's a little hard to understand why you've got Panetta representing the Department of Defense against it. You've got General Krulak, former head of the Marine Corps, and General Hoare, both writing very, very passionate rejections of this bill, saying that the American military should never be doing this kind of policing, let alone violating the rights of their own citizens that they're sworn to protect and defend. You had the FBI director weighing in. They didn't carry the day. So who the hell's pushing this thing? Who is behind this rush to shred our Constitution?
It is interesting here in D.C. A lot of us advocates are wondering the same question. I mean, it does seem to be a lot of smoke and mirrors. I will tell you that on the day of the Defense Authorization Act vote in the Senate last week, the speaker at the Republican luncheon was the former Vice President Dick Cheney. And there are certainly reports that he's been all over the Hill in the last several months. You know, when I would say that were the law equally applied, the man would have been in jail for the last several years. But he's not, and he's been free to promote his agenda. And it does seem that the neoconservative cabal that ran the White House under the Bush administration is today pulling strings in Congress and motivating laws that very much extend that paradigm. I mean, it's worth noting, we never saw anything even remotely as bad under the Bush administration. I mean, the Patriot Act was horrible. The FISA Amendments Act were horrible. The Military Commissions Act, all that stuff was bad, but nothing is as bad as the Defense Authorization Act in 2011. This compounds those abuses dramatically. And it is bizarre, quite frankly, that this is happening now. Having said all that, I do want to leave your listeners with one note of hope. Tomorrow happens to be the anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights. And there are dozens of grassroots actions planned around the country, including in Los Angeles. And there are opportunities for anybody to raise your voice. And I think this demonstration of the failure of Congress, this demonstration of the failure of the White House, this demonstration of the failure of our political process really, I think, compels Americans of conscience from whatever political persuasion you might have, you know, be you a right-wing, believer in whatever principles you might hold dear, or a left-wing adherent to whatever visions of equality. If you have a vision, or if you just believe anything that would at some point prompt you to raise your voice, this bill is very much a matter of your individual self-interest. And it's certainly a matter of the self-interest of our polity collectively, because if we close the space for dissent, if we remove due process, if we deny Americans the freedoms that have long made our country great, I think we not only do the terrorists work for them by undoing our society, but we also doom our next generation to a very dark potential future, and one certainly far darker than we who are alive today have had a chance to embrace.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Shahid Bhatar.
Thank you so much. If I may just tell your listeners where they can go to find more information, online at BORDC, that's Bill of Rights Defense Committee, BORDC.org/NDAA. You can click an interactive map and find an action near you, and I'd certainly encourage anyone who cares about the Bill of Rights or the Constitution to raise your voice tomorrow.
Again, I thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Shahid Bhatar, who is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution. Previously, he was Director of the National Program to Combat Racial and Religious Profiling by Federal Authorities, an Associate Director of the American Constitution Society, and a public interest litigator in private practice. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the real reason why the post office is in financial trouble.
Jack!